history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you're from in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there waiting to be heard. If only we'll ask a few questions and take the time to listen. Each week we visit with members of our greatest generation. We want our veterans to know that we appreciate their service and sacrifice, that we're not going to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take this journey, we're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories. And today we're in Las Vegas, Nevada, with 90-year-old Selwyn Dante, originally, well, born in Arkansas, but spent a good chunk of his life in Louisiana, just moved here from Houston, Texas 6 months ago, and has already had the adventure of a lifetime with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. We'll get to that. But Selwyn, I want to talk about this early stuff, because you don't remember it, I'm sure, but early on, your life was affected by a natural disaster. It was a flood that chased your family out of Arkansas?
That's right. Moved there with friends in Louisiana, North Louisiana.
In 1927?
1927. I was 6 months old.
You're wearing an LSU Tigers shirt, so I imagine life
in Louisiana. I'm a member of LSU Alumni Federation. That's my school.
I can tell you're very proud, and I'm surprised you haven't added a like EAUX to the end of your name or anything by now. But growing up in Louisiana, what was life like there in the South before World War II?
It was good. We didn't know anything about color differences. I played with blacks and whites.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the hardest hit I ever got was against playing catcher on a softball team for a black man that was swinging a bat. He caught me behind my ear, broke my eardrum, and fractured my skull. I'm standing, walking around, oh, help me, help me, help me. They took me to the hospital in Monroe, the nearest place from Winsboro, where I was living. And I said, all you got is a fractured skull. You'll get over it.
All you got is a fractured skull.
I got over it very well. Didn't hurt me one bit.
Monroe is in northeast Louisiana.
Right.
Beautiful spot there along the, what is it, the Ouachita River runs through there?
Ouachita River, correct.
Yep. In fact, General Claire Chennault lived in Monroe for a long time, a World War II hero.
He was born in Gilbert, Louisiana, just south of Winsboro.
Mm-hmm.
9 miles away. I know where his home is, 9 miles south of Winsboro.
Did you know that at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Did you guys hear the stories of the Flying Tigers?
Oh, yes. I knew all about them. We'd go down and see his house every once in a while. He was our first big hero.
I believe it. And since then, of course, Northeastern Louisiana University used to be the Indians. They changed it to the Warhawks because
right.
of the P-40 Warhawk that his Flying Tiger pilots flew in China during World War II. And now if you go to Monroe, they have a great General Chennault Flying Tigers Museum right there by the airport. But you, as a young man, you knew who he was. And
oh, yes.
That was a big deal.
Followed his exploits for quite a bit.
If you were following his exploits, you were aware that there was some turmoil in the world before America got into it.
Absolutely.
Was that kind of exciting that a guy from around your area was doing this big stuff in China?
That was very good.
Were you dreaming of being a Flying Tiger pilot?
No.
You weren't going that far.
I tried for the Air Force when I was at LSU. Went over to try to enlist in the Air Force and couldn't pass the test. I didn't have enough weight on me. I weighed 111 pounds. And I wanted to be a pilot. I had to put on some weight. I'd eat a couple of bananas and try to see if I could hit the weight, but I didn't make it, so I went back to school.
Everybody seems to have a memory about December 7th, 1941, where they were, how they found out. Is that true in your case?
I remember exactly where I was. I was in my backyard playing in Winsboro, Louisiana, and they told us about the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. And I'm a geography buff. I knew exactly where it was, what they were talking about. I had to just see what was going on. Turned the radio, and sat and listened to the radio for a long, long time. And then, of course, Monday, he declared war.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew once these days I'd be going pretty soon if I didn't finish it up in a hurry.
Well, because you were still in high school.
Yeah. I graduated at 17. And my first year, I went to Northeast Louisiana for one semester, then transferred to LSU. I remember very vividly listen to the radio of how bad it was. And then seeing those first pictures, it was terrible.
Did it make you want to do something about it?
Not enough to want to volunteer at my age. I was still a little bit young.
Yeah. So you finished high school and went off to junior college in LSU.
Then LSU. I enjoyed my time at Northeast because it was the first time I'd been up to college. It was only 30 miles away. A big difference.
Baton Rouge is a little further.
You're right. I used to love to hitchhike back and forth.
Yeah, you could do that back then, couldn't you?
Oh, yeah. No problem at all.
But you were drafted while you were there at LSU?
Yes.
How'd you feel about that?
Whatever was going to be, going to be. I didn't worry about it. I just accepted what came along.
You mentioned you had tried to enlist in the Army Air Corps. They didn't take you.
Wouldn't take me.
But now, with the way things are going, they need some soldiers, and they call your number.
They drafted me. I went to Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, then to Oklahoma, or Fort Sill, Oklahoma. That's where I took basic training. And when I finished basic training, they immediately shipped me out, got me overseas.
Yeah, they needed people there in a hurry.
To replace the Battle of the Bulge people that had been shot and killed and wounded.
And that was thousands and thousands, and you would end up on the tail end of the Battle of the Bulge. But I'm curious about, you know, that journey overseas, because here you are, a very young man.
Gosh, I was only 18, I believe.
So you're 18 years old.
18 years old.
And you're taking this voyage across the Atlantic. Had you ever been on a ship before?
Yes, but a small one.
You mean like on the river?
Yeah.
A river in the south is a far cry from the Atlantic Ocean.
I'd never taken a cruise before, that's what you're getting at.
Yeah. Were you anxious? Were you nervous? Were you wondering what you were going to encounter over there?
Not particularly. It was all a new experience for me. I was wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, ready to go where it was going to be.
I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember kind of what you expected, what you thought it was going to be like?
Well, I knew that I'd already lost a cousin in the war and had other members of my family that had been gone in the war. I just looked forward to whatever's going to come is going to come. I'm quite a fatalist in that respect.
What happened with your cousin? Did you know the story?
Missing in action from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Leon Brown.
Did you know him much at all?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Just knew that he was your cousin.
He's older than I am.
So you're 18 years old. You make it across the Atlantic?
I went on a motion liner from the Matson Lines called the Mariposa. It was fast enough to go by itself. It didn't have to have an escort and a convoy. New York, Camp Shanks to Liverpool, England. We were starting to go into the southern part, but they had a submarine attack. So I sent completely around Ireland to land at Liverpool and put me on a train, sent me to Southampton to get across the channel.
When you say they had a submarine attack, you mean on your ship or in the area?
In the area. So to keep them going to that dangerous area, they turned around the ship, went around Ireland completely to land in Liverpool.
And here, you'd still been in the States in June of 44 when America and the Allies invade Normandy. I'm sure you'd seen all those photos.
I followed. That's why I was so glad I happened to land on Omaha Beach.
You knew the significance.
Absolutely.
How many guys had died to take that beach?
Many thousands.
What did you see when you got there in January?
Oh, the beach had been cleared completely. It had a wharf built up for ships to dock there. They didn't have to get my feet wet at all.
But you'd be getting your feet wet in terms of war pretty soon. Was there a moment that was kind of the welcome to the war moment for you?
I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed then. Nothing affected me too much. Whatever was going to happen, I just look forward to see something different. As long as I keep my wits about me and stay alive, that was the main thing.
And I know you had some close calls over there. You ended up attached to the 84th Infantry Division, the 638th Tank Destroyer Battalion. But what was your specific job?
Well, when I joined the outfit, the Battle of the Bulge was just about ending, and they put me in headquarters company. Usually there are four enlisted men in headquarters company. They had all been killed. So I took care of all four men's positions.
Four different positions. What were those four?
Operations, intelligence, service, and supply. I was a sergeant for all of those outfits. I was a PFC.
Wow. I guess that kind of underscores the desperate nature of the situation.
You're right.
And the losses they had taken. Was that intimidating at all to know how many guys had died in this Battle of the Bulge that you caught the tail end of?
No, I expected the worst.
And how about the weather when you got there?
It was still rather cold. It was still snow on the ground in a lot of places. I had warmer clothes than they had at the Bulge Battle. Most of them, part of the Battle of the Bulge, didn't have warm enough clothing. I'll jump ahead of myself a minute. One of the men of the Battle of the Bulge, I'd never seen anybody else from my outfit, the 84th Infantry Division, or any of its detachments before, until I moved into an old folks' home in Houston.
Uh-huh.
Man I met there, he was in the Battle of the Bulge and the foxhole, and the water was up to his calves. His feet were frozen. Had to chop him out, and they wanted to cut his legs off. When he said, heck no, you're not coming there. Send him to the hospital in England, then send him home. And then I got to meet him. So that's the only time I've met anybody from my outfit ever and all my traveling.
All these years since. So you didn't have to deal with the harshest winter conditions that a lot of those guys at the Bulge did.
We were equipped with enough clothing to take care of it.
you mentioned to me that you're lucky to be here. And maybe some folks just hearing that story of your baseball injury, just a fractured skull, that they know you're thankful to be here. What were some of those close calls you experienced there in Europe?
Well, as I told you, I was at headquarters company of the battalion. So I drove the Jeep with an adjutant, First Lieutenant Sabi, and we led the convoy. Mm-hmm. And we had those dadgum tree-lined areas, hedgerows, that's what I'm trying to think of.
Yeah.
On the right-hand side and a forest on the left-hand side. And we got strafed by FW-190, had 37-millimeter cannons on it instead of machine guns. It started at the back of the column. By the time we got to the front of the column, a shell hit right behind my Jeep. It was a dud, bounced over my Jeep into a ditch. I was very lucky.
It hit behind your Jeep.
And bounced over my head.
Over your head.
Into the ditch on the side. You could see the thing smoking, but it went off. We went in the woods. Everybody cleared out of the vehicles and ran in the woods. We didn't want to get strafed anymore. So after that first strafing, he decided he'd just leave us alone.
What would have happened if that shell was not a dud?
It would have killed me.
No question.
No question. It was only about 4.5-5 feet behind me.
Where it bounced, if it had detonated there.
It would have killed me immediately.
Would have blown your Jeep over and...
Yeah.
Yep.
Killed both of us. 37-millimeter shell can give a pretty good explosion.
Well, and I wonder what the percentage is. What percentage of those shells were actually duds?
I don't think they had hardly any more of them.
Pretty rare.
I was very lucky. You have very seldom of time of a shell from a machine gun or a cannon being a dud. I'd never heard it before in my life.
What you do hear occasionally is that some of those were sabotaged and that the slave labor they had working in some of these camps, that they would, at the risk of their life, sabotage the shell to try to make it a dud. I mean, I guess that's a possibility there.
I never considered that thought. I
mean, who knows? It could have just been a dud. Maybe it was divine intervention.
You're right.
Nobody knows.
I never heard of any other person being strafed with the cannons and it being hit by, missed by a dud like that. The tanker store right behind me, the shell hit behind it, and a guy in the tanker store got a Purple Heart because he got hit.
Mm-hmm. So that was...
I was just lucky. Somebody looking out for me, I guess. When we went overseas, I forgot to tell you this. It was an important thing. My dad had an apartment store in Winsboro, and he had a seamstress in there working for him, and they would alter the clothes for the people that bought clothes. When I got on the ship, we were out in the middle of the Atlantic, and somebody called my name up on the second level. Turned around, and said, the man's, his mother worked for my father, Ray Clausen. He was a P-47 pilot, second lieutenant. He came down. I couldn't go up to see him, of course, because that's the officer's quarters, apparently.
Right.
He came down and talked to him for a while, and he promised to wire my folks when he got to Europe where I was, because I couldn't do any connecting with them at all. It was all top secret where I was going to. And he said he'd take care of him and let him know I was. That made him happy.
Did he do that?
Oh, yeah. I never did find out what happened to him at the end of the war. I don't know. I didn't follow up on a lot of things I probably should have followed up on.
But you know that he did follow through and let your parents know where you were.
Yes, no, because I got... No letters from him, email from him, to let me know what's going on. I'm a horrible correspondent. I didn't want to send anything back. I'm able to send 2 or 3 emails my entire time overseas.
Well, Mr. Dante was not able to keep in touch, but I am able now to fill in a couple of those blanks. That P-47 pilot who helped him out, Ray Clausen, did make it home from the war. He ended up as a flight instructor back home in northern Louisiana, and he was in business at the small airport in their hometown there for quite a while. In fact, if you go to the renovated Winsboro Municipal Airport today, you'll step into the Clausen Adams Terminal Building, bearing the name of Sal Dante's late friend. Ray Clausen passed away in 1994. He's buried there in Franklin Parish, Louisiana. And his grave marker reads, "A good man, a good pilot." I'm going to try to put Mr. Dante in touch with Mr. Clausen's family, but after this break, we're going to jump back into Sal's story, including an important detail that he'll share, adding some powerful perspective as to what he was fighting for in Europe during World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and three locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 90-year-old Sal Dante of Las Vegas, Nevada. He grew up in northern Louisiana, spent many of his later years in Houston, Texas, and just recently moved to Vegas. Later on, we're going to hear about his most recent adventure with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. But for now, back to what this teenager was doing with the 638th Tank Destroyer Battalion in Europe in 1945.
So you have that close call where you're driving the Jeep, the shell hits behind you, it's a dud, so you go on and you sit that out until the strafing is over.
That was the second time.
Oh, what was the first?
I forgot to tell you the first time. Well, bivouacked after I joined the outfit between Belgium and Holland on the borderline there. We were taking we took a convent. That's where we all bivouacked in it. I went up on the second floor. A buddy of mine sat against the wall on the left-hand side. And I sat on the right-hand side. We just sat on the wall, leaned our back against the wall, spread our legs out, and nighttime Charlie came along, strafing that place. First shell came over his head and hit between his legs, next between my legs, next over my head. He was gone.
Wow.
Twice in a row, I was lucky.
Yeah. And for folks who
scared the living devil out of me, I'll tell you that for sure. I shook like mad, but I got over it. Got in the Jeep and drove again.
I can see how that would get your attention.
Then we hit Market Garden. That was a big affair for the British in Holland.
Right, and I want to talk to you about that. And for folks who don't know what you're talking about, when you say Nighttime Charlie, that nickname, or some people call them Bedcheck Charlie.
Yeah.
But the Germans would send planes over every night to bomb or strafe, and this guy was strafing this convent where you were and came, what, we're talking about inches away from hitting you?
Well, bam, a foot away from my crotch.
Between your knees.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I was just sitting against the wall, my back against the wall, sitting against the wall. He was the same way, and the bullet came over his head and hit between his legs. Next one was between mine and over my head.
Wow.
We were very disappointed that it had to happen to be that way, because we have an outfit called the 557th. They had the spotlights for the catching the planes where they could hit them up high in the sky.
Right.
And they had a bivouac right beside our building. And when those damn searchlights drove the fire, we told them, get those dad guns away and move them away from us. We moved out the next day, though.
Uh-huh.
But that was a stupid thing to do, put us right next to the damn searchlights.
Yeah, nobody wants to be by the lights because those are
targets.
Spotlights
were drawing the fire.
Sure, sure. And I want to hear about Market Garden and your close calls there, but can you give us a sense of day-to-day, what a typical day would be like for you at this time? I mean, you're not even 19 years old yet. But you mentioned you had the responsibility of four guys.
Well, my first job when I got to the outfit, I just left Reams and joined them. And the first stop we had, they said, you've got to go to, with these two guys, grave registration, to pick up the remains of two boys that were hitting one of my tank destroyers. The major said, that's your job for today. I said, okay. Went with them. I got a pretty damn strong stomach. And they gathered our remains up in two little small poop sacks, little small flour sacks, put the remains in that. And brought them out. You want to see them? I said, yeah, I don't want to look at them. I got an iron stomach. So I looked at them and I said, oh, well, I have to know that you got their name tag so they can get it straightened out. And I gave them all the information they have to have for the information about the, what outfit we were in and everything. And then they took me back to the headquarters company of my battalion. And it's time for me to eat lunch right before I got back. So I had to come out and eat a K ration. I didn't want a C ration. I wanted a K ration. But it didn't spoil my appetite. I'm hard-nosed, I guess you might say. And my first experience in the war is having them recognize the remains and take them back for grave registration.
I was waiting for you to tell me that that iron stomach wasn't so iron in that situation, but you held it together, huh?
I held it together. We crossed the Atlantic Ocean. We got caught in one of the toughest storms you can catch. And everybody on the ship was seasick. It was, I told you, a luxury liner, a cruiser. It had 5,000 on a ship that carried 600 people. It had the bunks five stacked in every room.
Right.
The ones that grabbed the top bunk were the lucky ones. I didn't want anybody above me getting nauseated.
Yeah.
So I went for the top bunk. I got it and walked on the deck a lot of times because I never got seasick. I was very fortunate.
So you mentioned, you know, that first duty with the Graves Registration Unit. But on a day-to-day basis, what were some of the other things that you had to do that you were responsible for?
I had to type of reports, where we'd gone, what we'd done, and that was the main thing I had to do. Keep a record for the battalion to know what had transpired.
So in today, if we look up one of these after-action reports, those are the kinds of things you were typing?
That's right.
So, you know, for instance, January 24th, the division engaged the enemy here. This unit had these casualties. Maybe at some point this guy was awarded the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart.
That'd be done afterwards.
Right.
After
but, these are the kinds of things you did?
Yeah.
Got it. And some people might think, hey, that's a pretty safe job, but you're already giving us evidence that that wasn't necessarily the case.
In the war, nothing's safe.
Uh-huh.
When they're shooting at you, they're shooting at you.
Right. You mentioned something earlier about being a fatalist, that what was going to be was going to be. But were there times where you felt that fear or that thought that, you know, I may not wake up tomorrow?
Oh, yes. Lots of times I was scared to death. After we got straight that time of that shell hit and missed me.
Yeah.
Didn't go off. I couldn't even urinate. I was so scared. But I was shaking like a leaf.
Hard to blame you.
But I got over it pretty quickly.
You mentioned Market Garden. That was a big operation a few months before you got there that cost many Americans their lives. A daring attempt to secure areas around the Rhine River and potentially shorten the war. It did not have its desired effect, and those areas were still contested when you came through in the spring of 1945.
When we crossed the Rhine, they were shelling us like mad. We were with it, attached to the Second Army as Montgomery's outfit. They crossed the dadgum Rhine and stopped to have tea. We went on through them.
So the British get over these bridges.
I think it was their pontoon bridge that we went over. My outfit went over it.
Uh-huh. But you get over the bridge, and here are the British, and they're just sitting there.
Yeah.
Because it was tea time.
They didn't mind being shelled. I thought they were crazy as hell.
Were there some more close calls for you there?
No. We heard they went through that whole area because they were clearing them out pretty fast, and they wanted to get across the Rhine, and they wanted to make sure that we had a way to get across the Rhine. So when they got that pontoon bridge set up, they went across and stayed there near the edge of the Rhine to protect it from anybody coming to try to take it over. So we went through them, kind of went behind the lines a little bit, our fifth, but that's where we were. Tiger Storm Battalion seemed to be the lead of everything else. Our tanker store was a T-3 tank with no top on it. It had an open turret with a machine gun, 50 caliber machine gun mounted on top of it. It had a 76 millimeter cannon.
Right.
The Sherman tank had a 75 millimeter cannon on it, which wasn't as powerful for distances. We would go in a hurry because we could go 25 and 35 miles an hour, where a Sherman tank would be hard pressed to go better than 20. The Tiger tank couldn't go over 6 or 7 miles an hour. We'd go around behind it. That was the only vulnerable place they had on a Tiger tank, was the back rear or right left-hand corner, one of those two places. Everywhere else was so thick the armor, even high-piercing, high-explosive shell couldn't penetrate it. It bounced off like mad.
And you saw a lot of these encounters between American tanks and German tanks?
Yes.
Because that's what your outfit was designed to do, take out the enemy tanks.
That's right.
Did you get used to that? Did that ever become old hat, or was it always?
No, nothing becomes old hat. You keep your wits about you all the time, but you never know what's going to happen. As I've told you from different experiences I've had, it can happen in a hurry, and you can just be lucky if you make it through it.
Had you become aware at any point throughout this, I mean, I'm sure you're aware that Nazi Germany is trying to take over the world. Had you become aware of what was happening to the Jewish people?
And I'm Jewish, and I attended the first Pesach service in Europe. We did it in Belgium. All the troops anywhere in that vicinity. 1st, 3rd, 9th Army, and British 2nd Army had several hundred of us, Jewish people, to attend that Seder service in Belgium.
When was that?
First Passover.
Yep.
And I don't remember, is it March?
Either March or early April, yeah. 1945.
Uh-huh.
So being Jewish yourself.
I was more attentive to what was going on.
You knew what was happening.
I knew what was happening.
How did that make you feel about what you were doing and all these other guys with you were doing?
I was trying to do my best to save as many lives as I could. That was my object, is to try to see how much we could do to get rid of the Germans and save as many lives as we could to get them out of that place. We took over a concentration camp, my outfit, that 638 did, and they had already cleared everybody out. Instead of the 10-foot barbed wire fences there, that's unreal to have a fence 10 foot tall, but they wanted to catch them as they started climbing, they could shoot them. But they had gotten everybody out and it was all gone, went to the camp. It's rather cleaned up, surprisingly so. Ramshackle barracks, but we saw what it was going through. It was not too far from Hanover, because we took Hanover.
So, you know, I realize we're bouncing around here a little bit.
That's my fault.
No. But as folks hear you say that you are a Jewish American soldier in Europe. You've had these close calls with the enemy, Nazi Germany, which you're aware is persecuting, trying to exterminate the Jewish people. Did you ever consider the possibility that you might be captured and wonder what might happen to you if you were?
Yeah, I knew that if I got captured, I'd be in a hell of a mess. After I joined my outfit, we were driving in Germany. I was driving the Jeep, and the lieutenant said, let's go this way. And we went that way, and there was a dadgum MP said, no, you can't go this way. You got to go that way. I said, that's the wrong direction, sir. He said, follow the directions. I followed it. We ended up in a German town that hadn't even been captured yet. No soldiers left at all. The people were waving white sheets everywhere out of the windows and everything. I said, sir, we're in the wrong place. Let's get the hell out of here. I turned around and went back, and that MP was gone. He was a German officer, German soldier, dressed in MP uniform, directing us. That's what they did in the Battle of the Bulge. Sent you the wrong direction all the time. As soon as I saw I was out of jurisdiction of our men, I said, let's get the heck out of here. I turned that Jeep around and I came back, lickety split, went back to the battalion and planned our future skirmishes to the left instead of to the right.
That's like straight out of a cartoon, you know, where you see
the
bad character flips the sign around to point the other way. But
they did that over there plenty of times.
These are Germans in American uniforms speaking perfect English.
Yes.
I know you were just a teenager, but to be aware that Hitler and his regime were trying to eliminate the Jewish people just because they were Jewish, how did that make you feel?
I wanted to see that so-and-so gotten rid of in a hurry.
Could you even grasp that someone would want to do that?
No. Hard for me to understand how that could do something to somebody like that. After the war, seeing those pictures made me realize that we were lucky that we didn't have to kill more of them. Oh, I had one experience I didn't tell you about.
All right.
It was in Germany. I was sent to the left side of my battalion headquarters company to be a spotter. And the other man, a couple of yards down from me, on the perimeter of our bivouac area. All of a sudden, here comes this German officer towards me. I kept telling him, halt, stop, cease. I couldn't get him to stop. He turned around and started running. I had my carbine. I said, halt, stop, enough times. And he's about 60 or 70 yards from me, and I cracked down one shot in the middle of his back and killed him.
Mm.
I went and took what I could off of him. He happened to have a pistol. He was using a Spanish Martin automatic instead of a German Luger. I was hoping to get a Luger off of him. But I got food, but I still have it here.
Still have the pistol.
I took it out shooting it but just before I left Houston, a little over 6-7 months ago, to the firing range here. I shot expert with a pistol and expert with a rifle. I bought a rifle from him and just tried it out. I didn't lose my technique, so I'm glad about that.
You must have been shooting possums growing up in Louisiana or something.
I was a young black boy with a .22 rifle, single shot, bolt action. He would only shoot the eyes out of the squirrels, out of the trees. He was that good of a shot. He taught me how to shoot.
Uh-huh.
And back to the concentration camp. This is early April 1945. This was the Alam camp. In recent years, it's become the subject of a documentary called The Angel of Alam, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And it sounds like you're somewhat thankful that you got there after the prisoners had been evacuated.
I don't remember anything about the camp, quite frankly, except 10-foot-high barbed wire fences. I must have blotted it out of my mind. I knew exactly where it was. It was there, Hanover, Germany.
And
I tried to save some things out, but a few things I managed to save, I put in a little tin box, and I turned it into the Holocaust Museum here. I took all the medals off that German officer I'd killed and ribbons and everything he had on him and put that in the box.
So you remember this barbed wire fence, and you were aware of what had happened there?
Yeah. Before we went overseas, we already knew what had happened. We had heard reports before that because I had family that were killed in the Holocaust.
Cousins?
Our great aunt and all her children.
So as a Jewish American soldier, you come across the scene of where many Jews have been exterminated.
I think that they had satellite camps.
Yep.
And that's the one we could, was the first one we took was a satellite camp. They already moved everybody out into the big camp. That's why I said we didn't see anybody except 10-foot-high barbed wire fences. It was a small camp. Probably had about 5 or 6 cabins for the prisoners.
Right.
my first taste of a concentration type of camp.
And looking back now, is there some satisfaction for you knowing that even though you had a lot of help, I mean, there's 16 million Americans in uniform during World War II, but that you had a hand in this?
I did my part as much as I could.
And even though there were millions of lives that couldn't be saved.
True.
What you guys did over there spared the lives of a lot of Jews who would have been killed, as bad a shape as they were in when they were liberated.
A lot of them were liberated, barely could walk, couldn't even talk. You know, so I'm looking at the pictures of the Holocaust over and over again. It's a reminder of what can be if the world goes to pot again.
Well, yeah, that's often the most powerful impact of examining our past, isn't it? That hopefully we are not doomed to repeat it, but can learn from it. And we're learning a lot from Sel Dante. Time for another break, but when we come back, what the end of the war was like for him and what he got out of his trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV.
It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a fascinating conversation with a sharp and energetic 90-year-old. Sel Dante of Las Vegas has told us about his youth in Louisiana, his unique experience as a Jewish teenager serving in the 638th Tank Destroyer Battalion in Europe during World War II, and we're not done with that yet. Let's pick up right where we left off.
We got to the Elbe River 2 weeks before they surrendered. We had to stop there and wait for them to come, so we just a bivouac there and trying to enjoy ourselves, because the rest of the army was stopped waiting for the Russians to come, and the Poles were evacuating their area as much as they could. They were swimming across the Elbe River and trying to get away from the damn Russians. They knew what the Russians were like.
Yeah.
The Russians lost more people than anybody else in the whole damn war. Russians lost something like 30 million people.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of people when you stop and consider that.
And the ones who were around were pretty angry about it and were ready to get payback.
Yep.
Was VE Day a big deal for you?
Oh, I didn't think so.
No?
We had already cleared the place out, and there was nothing to do. We were sitting there waiting for it. They could have VE Day a week and a half early if they wanted to, but we had to wait for the damn Russians. After we left, I was stationed in a little place called Esperde, Germany, E-S-P-E-R-D-E. We loaded my crew, and we headed out south, went through Kassel, Germany. It was completely laid waste. There wasn't a brick, stacked on top of brick anywhere. It was all just rubble. Mm-hmm. They had bombed it to nothing. We went on to Heidelberg and took a left hand to a little town called Haspersheim on the Neckar River. That's where I did my occupation duty.
How long were you over there in occupation?
Not a whole long time. I came home to the States here before the war ended. I was on the high seas when they dropped the atomic bomb. Right before we went to Heidelberg, we took over a chateau that belonged to Admiral Dönitz, who was head of the German Navy, chief admiral of the German Navy. Mm-hmm. And we went in that place and we ransacked it pretty good. I got two swords off his mantelpiece, and I got a ceremonial dagger with a pearl handle and a silver cord braided to it. That was my souvenirs right quickly, and that's all I could handle. I barely got those two swords in my big duffel bag. I got it back to the States safe and sound.
And really, those are significant pieces of history. Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz was actually the man who signed the Nazi surrender on May 8th, because by that time, he was the top-ranking German military official.
He had a wonderful mansion there, some estate. I gave the two swords to my first cousin living in Detroit, Michigan. He put them over his mantelpiece, but they were beautiful.
You mentioned that, you know, you lost your cousin before you went overseas. You've got other relatives who were killed in the Holocaust. But as far as the guys that you served with in your unit, did you have to deal with the loss of any of those guys that you got to know?
I wasn't close enough to any of them. Short time I was there. If a tank got destroyed, all I had to do is make a report on such were killed in action. I didn't do much typing. We didn't have time to do much typing, quite frankly. Always on the go.
What was the most challenging part of the whole experience for you?
It was all challenging. I can't pick out one particular time. I'm just so happy that I'm still here alive. That's the main thing. I went through hell like the rest of them, but I survived it. That's the main thing I want to do is survive it. But I was scared as devil most of the time. Anybody says they weren't scared, it's a damn liar.
Did you ever hear from home while you were over there?
Oh, yeah. Every time I got a box of cookies from home, they were all crushed up. Never could make it in one piece, but Mom sent me three or four boxes of cookies while I was overseas. I loved to share them with the boys. We always eat the crumbs on our fingers. That's all we had to do. That's all she could send was cookies.
And you made mention of this earlier, but I'd like to dive into it a little deeper. You've been over there a few months already. You've survived some of these close encounters where your life could have ended as a teenager. And then here comes Passover, and there's this Seder service. You're close to the front lines.
Yeah, we're on the front line almost all the time.
You know that the Jewish people are being slaughtered, but you have occasion to observe the most significant holiday of your faith. With Passover. Other Jewish Americans and British and a lot of nationalities, right?
I'm sure there were. Had over 1,000 people there for the Passover services, if I remember correctly.
Is Passover something that you had celebrated back home?
Always.
Every year?
Every year. I quit fasting 2 years ago. Hmm. I fasted every year for 88 years.
Why'd you stop?
I got to where I couldn't take it. My stomach.
Physically?
Too many problems to contend with.
Mm-hmm. So your whole life, Passover is a significant thing.
Absolutely.
You fast, you read the story of Moses and the Israelites in Egypt.
Oh, yeah.
It's a big deal. But that Passover, 1945, with 1,000 other soldiers who are fighting this war against an enemy that wants to exterminate the Jews. What was that like?
That had great significance, because that was the first Passover that they had had in, I guess, 5 or 6 years before anybody had Passover.
The significance of the words you read and the ceremonies that you carry out, did it take on greater meaning there?
Well, my grandfather was a part-time rabbi. He took on the religious responsibilities of all of Southeast Arkansas. Mm. They didn't have a rabbi, so he was their acting rabbi. And when he left Arkansas in 27, they gave him a gold watch inscribed, "Thanks from the Jews of Southeast Arkansas for being their rabbi."
Mm-hmm.
I have that watch. I gave it to my oldest son. He's got it mounted under a dome so he can look at it and think about it every once in a while. But I've been from a religious family for all my life.
And I'm sure that you'd always been able to imagine what Moses and all of these Israelites in captivity in Egypt,
yes,
were thinking when the original Passover happened. But to be there in a war zone, knowing that your life is at stake and all these 1,000 Jewish soldiers with you, their lives are at stake. What went through your mind as you participated in these same things you'd done your whole life in a very different setting?
I've gotten to that point where I wasn't scared. Just accepted things for what they were. I was so happy to be able to celebrate Passover. It's a very important holiday. I'm a strong believer in the Jewish faith. It's never going to be eliminated completely. It's not possible. Don't care what they say. They can all hem and haw about it. But you cannot kill all the Jews on earth. Even though we're a small minority of the billions of people here we have, you're not going to be able to get rid of us. I don't think the Lord let it.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. If in that moment, as not even a 19-year-old yet, You're still 18 years old, celebrating Passover, knowing that those people thousands of years ago were spared. Is there a real belief?
That never entered my mind at all then. I'm more interested in seeing about the war ending and us getting rid of those damn Nazis. I didn't even think about that at all. I know it'd be a lot to consider that way, but it never entered my mind to think about that. All I want to do is complete the job of getting rid of the Nazis.
What I wondered is if in that moment there was a belief that you weren't in that fight alone, that just as the Israelites had divine help, that you would in this situation.
It proved me already twice.
With the shell that was a dud and the bullet between your legs?
Yeah.
So for you, that's that angel of death passing over the doorpost with the blood on it.
You're right.
So I know we're bouncing around again, but you mentioned VE Day, and then you weren't there in occupation too long, and that the bomb was dropped in the Pacific while you were on your way home.
Right.
Were you concerned that you may have to go to the Pacific?
That's what we were going to.
You were?
We were supposed to go to the Pacific. We wore a crack outfit. They wanted us to get overseas pretty quickly. When we left Antwerp, we were in the middle of the Atlantic when the first bomb hit, and before we docked in Camp Miles Standish in Boston, the second bomb had already hit. And we were sure that the war was going to end up. It did end up. While we were on high seas, it was over with. So we didn't have to go to Japan, so we were happy.
What did it feel like to be back in America?
I got down and kissed the ground when I got home.
Did you really?
A lot of us did.
Uh-huh.
A lot of us survived. We were just glad to be able to kiss good old American soil. USA is our home.
And I know you're still, you know, when you get home, you're 19. But how different was it to jump back into life again after being through what you'd been through?
I'm a fatalist. I take things in stride pretty easily. I was just happy to have things over with over there and back home again.
Mm-hmm.
See, my mother and father helped me out a heck of a lot.
And you went back to LSU?
Went back to LSU. I ended up as a petroleum engineer living in Lafayette, Louisiana. And living in Lafayette, you got to go offshore. Now, I cannot swim a lick. I'm scared of the water. Getting water this high, I lose my breath. Consequently, I had to do something different. So I left the petroleum engineering and I went into merchandising. I'd been brought up in my dad's store. When I was 9 years old, I sold a pair of shoes.
Hmm.
So I've been selling ever since.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I'd go to Alaska and sell the Eskimos icebreakers if I had to. But my dad brought me up right.
You want to talk about the honor flight a little bit?
Okay.
You heard about the honor flight a while ago.
Oh, yeah. I tried my best to get on it while I was in Houston.
But you got
sick? 2.5, 3 years ago.
Uh-huh. Didn't work out. You weren't well enough to go when it actually came around.
Everything came along at the wrong time for me.
So then you move here to Vegas.
Move to Vegas.
Get on the list. And you get to go from Las Vegas to Washington, D.C. Your son is your guardian on the trip. What was that like for you? What did you get out of that?
It was a wonderful experience because I had to go see all the great, they're not monuments. There's only one monument. That's the Washington Monument.
Right.
That's a quiz show problem. How many monuments have in Washington, D.C.? They got one. The rest of them are honored places.
A lot of memorials.
Memorials. That's the word I was trying to get.
Yeah. So you saw the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the Korean War Veterans Memorial.
The World War II Memorial.
And at that World War II Memorial.
The Ladies Memorial had just been opened up. That's a very nice one. Well done.
At Arlington, where you also saw the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier.
Oh, yes.
And your cousin was MIA in World War II, so that tomb, in a way, is dedicated to him. But at that World War II Memorial, all those gold stars, 406,000 Americans who died, you were almost one of them. Couple times. You're there with your son, who wouldn't have been born if you were one of
them. Right.
What kind of emotions did you guys encounter while you were there at that site?
Well, I'm pretty emotional. I teared up like everybody should tear up. Couldn't help myself. It's human nature to cry a little bit when you see all this stuff and feel it. You feel it in your heart for sure. We're very, very happy that we all have survived this far. But I had a blast of a time. They greeted us the same way they greeted us going and coming. Fire truck spraying water on top of the buses. Quite a thrill. And the police escort was unreal. The president couldn't have gotten away any faster than we did.
How about when you came back to Las Vegas?
That was the exciting part there. We had approximately 2,000 people at the airport to welcome us back. The fire trucks, of course, had given us a big water cannon salute. And if it came off the plane, who's going to be first? I'm always the number one off the plane. First one on the plane, they have a brigadier general there to greet us, shake our hand, and they have about 30 sailors. They greeted us and welcomed us home again. That was an experience. I tell you, they had people leading us all the way down the line with everybody holding up posters. My family was there to greet me. We went all around the dadgum terminal, everybody shouting to us and clapping for us. It was great. I'm getting choked up over that. See, I am pretty silly. At least 2,000 people lined up. Welcome back. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
And aside from just a few relatives, that's 2,000 people that you'd never met before.
Absolutely right.
In fact, you just moved here. But they were there because you did something that mattered. Did that whole experience give you a newfound appreciation of just
how... Absolutely.
Yeah?
I'm a sentimental guy. It makes me get choked up when I think about something like that. But it was quite an experience.
Now, you said it changed your perspective about what you had done. Did it change your perspective about America or young people or the future to see those people there?
It helped my feelings in somewhat. But today's younger generation hasn't had a chance to really develop any kind of likes and dislikes about something like this. So many of them don't know what went on, and they can't compare it to anything else. The older people that knew what was going on, like Vietnam veterans, Korean veterans, and myself, we had a tendency to kind of want to forget about it, because I never told anybody about my experiences until just recently.
Why didn't you want to talk about it?
I don't know. I was so disgusted with the world because of what had been done to the Jews. That was my first thing to think about, is the Holocaust and what they had gone through there, particularly since I had lost family there.
Yeah.
And so many people don't even believe it today, and it hurts my feelings to think that people can be so ignorant as not accept the true facts of the situation.
Especially if they examine the evidence.
You're right.
Look at still photographs and moving pictures that were taken at Buchenwald and Auschwitz and all of these places.
I brought back some pictures of the concentration camp. I gave it to the Holocaust Museum in that little box I had.
Well, a couple of things. I want to say thank you. Thank
You're
you for serving
welcome.
Our country. Thank you for talking about it. And it strikes me that one of the best ways to address what you're talking about, the lack of awareness of younger generations today, is to do what you're doing, to tell your story, to say what you saw. If there's one thing that your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids could hold on to, could remember, could never forget about that time in our history that you lived through, that you had such a personal role in, what would that be? What do you want them to hold on to?
Keep the religion. That's most important. Keep the religion. Jews are never going to die out. They just can't get rid of us. But I'm hoping my kids realize that, my grandkids and my great-grandkids realize that. They have something to look forward to. Blessings of the Lord.
What would you say you're most proud of and most thankful for?
I'm thankful to still be alive. I'm proud I was able to serve my country. Of course, I'm proud of my family. That's why I'm most proud of my family first.
And we know that your family is awfully proud of you and thankful for your legacy. That is Selwyn Dante, 90 years old, and he told me, yes, his LSU Tigers will beat Alabama on the gridiron this year. Stay tuned for that. You'll find a photo of him wearing his alma mater's colors at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time for today. I do want to thank Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for connecting us to Sel and the unique story he shared with us. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time, and reminding you once more that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.